in me, and when I finally woke up, I couldn't remember a thing. I'd forgotten my father's face, my mother's face, how to read, how to add, what my house looked like inside, even my own name. My head was completely empty, like a bathtub after you pull the plug. They tell me before the accident, Nakata always got good marks. But then I collapsed, and when I woke up, I was not so bright. My mother died a long time ago, but she used to cry about this a lot, because I became stupid. My father never cried, but he was always angry.
Instead of being smart, though, you found yourself able to talk with cats.
That's correct.
Interesting.
Besides that, I'm always healthy and haven't been sick once. I don't have any cavities and don't have to wear glasses.
As far as I can tell, you seem fairly intelligent.
Is that so? Nakata said, inclining his head. Nakata's well past 60 now, Mr. Otsuka. Once I got past 60, I was quite used to being dumb and people not having anything to do with me. You can survive without going on trains. Father's dead, so nobody hits me any more. Mother's dead, too, so she doesn't cry. So actually, if you say I'm pretty smart, it's a bit upsetting. You see, if I'm not dumb, then the governor won't give me a subsidy any more, and no more special bus pass. If the governor says, you're not dumb after all, then Nakata doesn't know what to say. So this is fine, being dumb.
What I'm trying to say is your problem isn't that you're dumb, Otsuka said, an earnest look on his face.
Really?
Your problem is that your shadow is a bit, how should I put it,
faint.
I thought this the first time I laid eyes on you, that the shadow you cast on the ground is only half as dark as that of ordinary people.
I see.
I ran across another person like that once. Mouth slightly ajar, Nakata stared at Otsuka.
You mean you saw somebody like Nakata?
Yes, I did. That's why I wasn't so surprised that you could talk to cats.
When was that?
A long time ago, when I was still a youngster. But I can't remember the details, the person's face, or name, or where and when we met. As I said before, cats don't have that sort of memory.
I see.
That person's shadow, too, looked as though half of it had become separated from him. It was as faint as yours.
I see.
What I think is this. You should give up looking for lost cats and start searching for the other half of your shadow. Nakata tugged a few times at the peak of his hat in his hands.
To tell the truth, Nakata's had that feeling before, that my shadow is weak. Other people might not notice, but I do.
That's good, then, the cat said.
But I'm old and may not live much longer. Mother's already dead. Father's already dead. Whether you're smart or dumb, can read or can't, whether you've got a shadow or not, once the time comes, everybody passes on. You die and they cremate you. You turn into ashes and they bury you at a place called Karasuyama. Karasuyama's in Setagaya Ward. Once they bury you there, though, you probably can't think about anything any more. And if you can't think, then you can't get confused. So isn't the way I am now just fine? What I can do, while I'm alive, is never go out of Nakano Ward. When I die, though, I'll have to go to Karasuyama. That can't be helped.
What you think about is entirely up to you, of course, Otsuka said, and again began licking the pads of his paw. Now you should consider how your shadow feels about it. It might have a bit of an inferiority complex. As a shadow, that is. If I were a shadow, I know I wouldn't like to be half of what I should be.
I understand, Nakata said. You may well be right. Nakata's never thought about it. I'll think about it more after I get home.
An excellent idea. The two of them were silent for a while. Nakata stood up, carefully brushing away stray bits of grass from his trousers, and put on his threadbare hat. He adjusted it a few times until he got the angle just right. He shouldered his canvas bag and said,
"Thank you very kindly. Nakata really values your opinions, Mr. Otsuka. I hope you stay happy and well."
"You too." After Nakata left, Otsuka lay down again in the grass and closed his eyes. There was still some time before the clouds would come and the rain would start. His mind a blank, he fell asleep for a short nap.
7. At 7:15, I eat breakfast in the restaurant next to the lobby. Toast, hot milk, ham and eggs. But this free hotel breakfast doesn't come close to filling me up. The food's all gone before you realize it, and I'm still hungry. I look around, and second helpings of toast don't seem likely to materialize. I let out a big sigh. "Well, what are you going to do?" the boy named Crow says. He's sitting across from me. "You're not at home anymore, where you can stuff yourself with whatever you like," he says. "I mean, you've run away from home, right? Get that into your head. You're used to getting up early and eating a huge breakfast, but those days are long gone, my friend. You'll have to scrape by on what they give you. You know what they say about how the size of your stomach can adjust to the amount of food you eat? Well, you're about to discover if that's really true. Your stomach's going to get smaller, though that'll take some time. Think you can handle it?" "Yeah, I can handle it," I reply. "Good," Crow tells me. "You're supposed to be the toughest 15-year-old on the planet, remember?" I give him a nod. "Well then, how about you stop staring at your empty plate and get a move on?" Following this advice, I stand up and go to the front desk to negotiate over the price of my room. I explain I'm a student at a private high school in Tokyo, and have come here to write my graduation paper. Which isn't a total lie, since the high school affiliated with my school has this kind of setup. I add that I'm collecting material for the paper at the Komura Memorial Library. There's much more to research than I'd imagined, so I'll have to stay at least a week in Takamatsu. But, since I'm on a budget, would the discounted room rate be possible not just for 3 days, but for the whole time I'm here? I offer to pay each day in advance, and promise not to be any trouble. I stand there, in front of the girl in charge, trying to do my best imitation of a nice, well-brought-up young man who's in a tight spot. No dyed hair for me. No piercings. I have on a clean, white Ralph Lauren polo shirt, chinos, and a pair of brand new topsiders. My teeth are gleaming, and I smell like soap and shampoo. I know how to speak politely. When I feel like it, I'm pretty good at impressing people older than me. The girl listens in silence, nodding, her lips slightly twisted up. She's petite, and wearing a green uniform blazer over a white blouse. She looks a little sleepy, but goes about her morning duties briskly. She's about the same age as my sister. "I understand," she says, "but I have to clear it with the manager. We should have an answer for you by noon." Her tone is businesslike, but I can tell that as far as she's concerned, I pass. She writes down my name and room number. I have no idea whether this negotiating will get me anywhere. It might blow up in my face. If the manager demands to see my student ID, say, or tries to get in touch with my parents. Of course I gave a false home number when I registered. But seeing as how my funds are limited, I reckon it's worth the risk. I check the yellow pages, and call a public gym and ask about their weight machines. They have most of what I need, and it only costs 500 yen a day. I get directions from the station, thank them, and hang up. I go back to my room for my backpack, then hit the street. I could just leave my stuff in the room, or in the hotel safe, but I feel better carrying it all with me. It's as if it's a part of me already, and I can't let go. On the bus from the terminal in front of the station to the gym, I can feel my face tighten, I'm so nervous. Suppose somebody asks why a boy my age is traipsing off to the gym in the middle of the day. I don't know this town and have no idea what these people are thinking. But no one gives me a second glance. I'm starting to feel like the Invisible Man or something. I pay the entrance fee at the desk, no questions asked, and get a key to a locker. After changing into shorts and a t-shirt in the locker room, I do some stretching exercises. As my muscles relax, so do I. I'm safe inside this container that is me. With a little click, the outlines of this being, me, fit right inside and are locked neatly away, just the way I like it. I'm where I belong. I start on my circuit training. With Prince blasting away on my Walkman, I put in a good hour of training, making my usual round of the 7 machines. I was sure a gym in such a small town would be full of outdated machines, but these are the latest models, with the metallic smell of brand new steel. The first round I do with light weights, then increase the weight for the second circuit. I know exactly how much weight and how many reps work for me. Pretty soon I start to sweat, and stop every once in a while to take a swig from the bottle and a bite out of a lemon I bought on the way to the station. Once I've finished training, I take a hot shower using the soap and shampoo I've brought along. I do a good job of washing my cock, not too many years out of its foreskin, under my arms, balls and bum. I weigh myself and flex my muscles a bit in front of a mirror. Finally, I rinse out my sweaty shorts and t-shirt in the sink, wring them out and stow them in a plastic bag. I take a bus back to the station and have a steaming bowl of udon in the same cafe as the day before. I take my time, gazing out the window as I eat. The station's packed with people streaming in and out, all of them dressed in their favorite clothes, bags or briefcases in hand, each one dashing off to take care of some pressing business. I stare at this ceaseless, rushing crowd, and imagine a time 100 years from now. In 100 years, everybody here, me included, will have disappeared from the face of the earth and turned into ashes or dust. A weird thought, but everything in front of me begins to seem unreal, as if a gust of wind could blow it all away. I spread my hands in front of me and take a good hard look at them. What am I always so tense about? Why this desperate struggle just to survive? I shake my head, turn from the window, clear my mind of thoughts of 100 years away. I'll just think about now. About books waiting to be read in the library, machines in the gym I haven't worked out on. Thinking about anything else isn't going to get me anywhere. That's the ticket, Crow tells me. Remember, you're supposed to be the toughest 15-year-old on the planet. As on the day before, I buy a box lunch at the station and take the train, arriving at the Komura Library at 11:30. And sure enough, Oshima's there at the counter. Today he's wearing a blue rayon shirt, buttoned to the neck, white jeans, and white tennis shoes. He's sitting at his desk, absorbed in some massive book, with the same yellow pencil, I guess, lying beside him. His fringe is all over his face. When I come in, he looks up, smiles, and takes my backpack from me. Still not going back to school, I see. I'm never going back, I confess. A library's a pretty good alternative, then, he says. He turns round to check the time on the clock behind him, then goes back to his reading. I head off to the reading room, and back to the Arabian Nights. As always, once I settle down and start flipping pages, I can't stop. The Burton edition has all the stories I remember reading as a child, but they're longer, with more episodes and plot twists, and so much more absorbing that it's hard to believe they're the same. They're full of obscene, violent, sexual, basically outrageous scenes. Like the genie in the bottle, they have this sort of vital, living sense of play, of freedom, that common sense can't keep bottled up. I love it, and can't let go. Compared to those faceless hordes of people rushing through the train station, these crazy, preposterous stories of 1,000 years ago are, at least to me, much more real. How that's possible, I don't know. It's pretty weird. At 1 o'clock, I go out to the garden again, sit on the porch, and eat my lunch. I'm about halfway through when Oshima comes over and says that I have a phone call. A phone call, I say, taken aback. For me. So long as your name's Kafka Tamura. I blush, get to my feet, and take the cordless phone from him. It's the girl at the front desk at the hotel, most likely checking to see if I'm really doing research at the library. She sounds relieved to find out I hadn't been lying to her. I talked with the manager, she says, and he says that they've never done this before, but seeing as you're young and there are special circumstances, he'll make an exception and let you stay at the rate the YMCA arranged for you. We're not so busy right now, he said, so we can bend the rules a bit. He also said that library's supposed to be really nice, so he hopes you'll be able to take your time and do as much research as you need to. I breathe a sigh of relief and thank her. I feel bad about lying, but there's not much I can do about it. I've got to bend some rules if I want to survive. I hang up and hand the phone back to Oshima. You're the only high school student who comes here, so I thought it must be for you, he says. I told her you're here from morning till night, your nose stuck in a book, which is true. Thanks, I tell him. Kafka Tamura. That's my name. Kind of strange. Well, that's my name, I insist. I assume you've read some of Kafka's stories. I nod. The castle, and the trial, Metamorphosis, plus that weird story about an execution device. In the penal colony, Oshima says. I love that story. Only Kafka could have written it. That's my favorite of his short stories. Really? I nod. Why's that? It takes me a while to gather my thoughts. I think what Kafka does is give a purely mechanical explanation of that complex machine in the story as sort of a substitute for explaining the situation we're in. What I mean is, I have to give it some more thought. What I mean is, that's his own device for explaining the kind of lives we lead. Not by talking about our situation, but by talking about the details of the machine. That makes sense, Oshima says, and lays a hand on my shoulder, the gesture natural and friendly. I imagine Franz Kafka would agree with you. He takes the cordless phone and disappears back into the building. I stay on the veranda for a while, finishing my lunch, drinking my mineral water, watching the birds in the garden. For all I know, they're the same birds from yesterday. The sky is covered with clouds, not a speck of blue in sight. Oshima most likely found my explanation of the Kafka story convincing, to some extent at least. But what I really wanted to say didn't get across. I wasn't just giving some general theory of Kafka's fiction. I was talking about something very real. Kafka's complex, mysterious execution device wasn't some metaphor or allegory. It's actually here, all around me. But I don't think anybody would get that. Not Oshima. Not anybody. I go back to the reading room, where I sink down in the sofa and into the world of the Arabian Nights. Slowly, like a film fade-out, the real world evaporates. I'm alone, inside the world of the story. My favorite feeling in the world. When at 5 I'm about to leave, Oshima's still behind the counter, reading the same book, his shirt still without a single wrinkle. As always, a couple of strands of hair have fallen over his face. The hands of the electric clock on the wall behind him tick soundlessly on. Everything around him is silent and clean. I doubt the guy ever sweats or hiccups. He looks up and hands me my backpack. He frowns a bit, like it's too heavy for him. Do you take the train here from town? I nod. If you're going to come every day, you should have this. He hands me a sheet of paper, the train timetable, it turns out, between Takamatsu Station and the station where I get off for the library. They usually run on time. Thanks, I say, slipping the sheet into my backpack. Kafka, I don't have any idea where you've come from or what your plans are. But you can't stay in a hotel forever, right? He says, choosing his words carefully. With the fingers of his left hand, he checks the tips of his pencils. Not that it's necessary, since they're all as sharp as can be. I don't say anything. I'm not trying to interfere, believe me. I just thought I might as well ask. A boy your age, in a place you've never been before, I can't imagine it's easy going. I nod again. Are you heading somewhere else after here? Or are you going to be here for a while? I haven't decided yet. But I think I'll be here for a while. No other place to go, I admit. Maybe I should tell Oshima everything. I'm pretty sure he won't put me down, give me a lecture, or try to force some common sense on me. But right now, I'm trying to keep what I say to a minimum. Besides, I'm not exactly used to telling people how I feel. For the time being, then, you think you can manage? Oshima asks. I give a short nod. Good luck, then, he says. Apart from a few minor details, I spend the next 7 days in the same way. Apart from Monday, of course, when the library's closed and I spend the day at a big public library. The alarm clock gets me up at 6:30 every morning, and I gulp down the hotel's pseudo-breakfast. If the chestnut-haired girl's behind the front desk, I give her a little wave. She always nods and repays me with a smile. I think she likes me, and I kind of like her too. Could she be my sister? The thought does cross my mind. Every morning, I do some easy stretching exercises in my room. And when the time rolls around, I go to the gym and run through the usual circuit training. Always the same amount of weight, the same number of reps. No more, no less. I take a shower and wash every inch of me. I weigh myself to make sure my weight's staying steady. Before noon, I take the train to the Komura Library, exchange a few words with Oshima when I give him my backpack, and when I pick it up, eat lunch out on the veranda, and read. When I finish the Arabian Nights, I tackle the complete works of Natsume Soseki. There's still a couple of his novels I haven't read yet. At 5, I leave the library. So, most of the day, I'm in the gym or the library. As long as I'm in one of those two, nobody seems to worry about me. Chances are pretty slim a kid skipping school would hang out in either one. I eat dinner at the cafe in front of the station. I try to eat as many vegetables as I can, and occasionally buy fruit from a stand and peel it using the knife I took from my father's desk. I buy cucumbers and celery, wash them in the sink at the hotel, and eat them with mayonnaise. Sometimes I pick up a carton of milk from the local shop and have a bowl of cereal. In my room, I jot down in my diary what I did that day. Listen to Radiohead on my Walkman, read a little, and then it's lights out at 11. Sometimes I masturbate before going to sleep. I think about the girl at the front desk, putting any thoughts of her potentially being my sister out of my head for the time being. I hardly watch any TV or read any newspapers. But on the evening of the 8th day, as had to happen sooner or later, this simple, centripetal life is blown to bits.
8. U.S. Army Intelligence Section MIS Report, dated May 12, 1946. Title, Report on the Rice Bowl Hill Incident, 1944. Document number, PTYX-722-8936745-42216-WWN. The following is a taped interview with Dr. Shigenori Tsukuyama, 52, professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the School of Medicine, Tokyo Imperial University, which took place over a 3-hour span at the GHQ of the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers. Documentation related to the interview can be accessed using application number PTYX-722-SQ-267-291. Note, documents 271 and 278 are missing. Impressions of the interviewer, Lieutenant Robert O'Connor. Professor Tsukuyama was quite calm and relaxed throughout the interview, as one might expect of an expert of his caliber. He is one of the leading psychiatrists in Japan and has published a number of outstanding books on the subject. Unlike most Japanese, he avoids vague statements, drawing a sharp distinction between fact and conjecture. Before the war, he was an exchange scholar at Stanford, and is quite fluent in English. He is surely well-liked and respected by many.
We were ordered by the military immediately to undertake an examination of the children in question. It was the middle of November, 1944. It was quite unusual for us to receive requests or orders from the military. The military, of course, had its own extensive medical branch, and being a self-contained entity that put a high priority on secrecy, They usually preferred to handle matters internally. Apart from the rare times when they needed the special knowledge and techniques that only outside researchers or physicians had, they seldom appealed to civilian doctors or researchers. Thus, when they broached this, we immediately surmised that something out of the ordinary had occurred. Frankly, I didn't like working under military direction. In most cases, their goals were strictly utilitarian, with no interest in pursuing truth in an academic sense, only arriving at conclusions that accorded with their preconceptions. They weren't the type of people swayed by logic. But it was wartime, and we couldn't very well say no. We had to keep quiet and do as we were told. We'd been continuing our research despite the American air raids. Most of our undergrads and grad students, though, had been drafted. Students in psychiatry weren't exempt from the draft, unfortunately. When the order came from the military, we dropped everything and took a train to...
Name deleted.
In Yamanashi Prefecture. There were three of us, myself and a colleague from the Department of Psychiatry, as well as a research physician from the Department of Neurosurgery, with whom we'd been conducting research. As soon as we got there, they warned us that what they were about to reveal was a military secret we could never divulge. Then they told us about the incident that had occurred at the beginning of the month. How 16 schoolchildren had lost consciousness in the hills, and 15 of them had regained consciousness thereafter, with no memory of what had taken place. One boy, they told us, hadn't regained consciousness, and was still in a military hospital in Tokyo. The military doctor who'd examined the children right after the incident, an internal medicine specialist named Major Toyama, gave us a detailed explanation of what had transpired. Many army doctors are more like bureaucrats, concerned with protecting their own little preserve than with medicine. But fortunately, Major Toyama wasn't one of them. He was honest and straightforward, and obviously a talented physician. He never tried to use the fact that we were civilians to lord it over us or conceal anything from us, as some might have done. He provided all the details we needed in a very professional manner and showed us medical records that had been kept on the children. He wanted to get to the bottom of this as much as anybody. We were all quite impressed by him. The most important fact we gleaned from the records was that, medically speaking, the incident had caused no lasting impact on the children. From right after the event to the present day, the examinations and tests consistently indicated no internal or external abnormalities. The children were leading healthy lives, just as they had before the incident. Detailed examinations revealed that several of the children had parasites, but nothing out of the ordinary. Otherwise, they were asymptomatic. No headaches, nausea, pain, loss of appetite, insomnia, listlessness, diarrhea, nightmares, nothing. The one notable thing, though, was that the two-hour span during which the children had been unconscious in the hills was erased from their memory, as if that part had been extracted in toto. Rather than a memory loss, it was more a lack of memory. These aren't medical terms, and I'm using them for the sake of convenience, but there's a considerable difference between loss and lack. I suppose it's like, well, imagine a train steaming down a track. The freight's disappeared from one of the cars. A car that's empty inside, that's loss. When the whole car itself has vanished, that's lack. We discussed the possibility that the children had breathed in poison gas. Major Toyama said that naturally they'd considered this. That's why the military is involved, he told us. But it seems a remote possibility. He then told us, "Now this is a military secret, so you can't tell anyone. The army is definitely developing poison gas and biological weapons, but this is carried out mainly by a special unit on the Chinese mainland, not in Japan itself. It's too dangerous a project to attempt in a place as densely populated as Japan. I can't tell you whether or not these sorts of weapons are stored anywhere in Japan, though I can assure you most definitely that they are not kept anywhere in Yamanashi Prefecture.
So he stated categorically that special weapons, including poison gas, were not being stored in the prefecture.
Correct. He was very clear about that. Basically, we had no choice but to believe him, and he sounded believable. We also concluded that it was highly unlikely that poison gas had been dropped from a B-29. If the Americans had actually developed such a weapon and decided to use it, they'd drop it on some large city, where the effects would be massive. Dropping a canister or two over such a remote place wouldn't allow them to ascertain what effects the weapon had. Besides, even if you accepted the premise that a poison gas had been dropped, any gas that makes children fall unconscious for 2 hours and has no other lasting effects would be worthless as military arsenal. Also, we knew that no poison gas, whether man-made or naturally occurring, would act like this, leaving no after-effects whatsoever. Especially when you're dealing with children, who are more sensitive and have a more delicate immune system than adults, there would have to be some after-effects, particularly in the eyes or mucous membranes. We crossed off food poisoning for the same reason. So what we were left with were psychological problems, or problems dealing with brain function. In a case like that, standard medical methodology wouldn't help at all in isolating the cause. The effects would be invisible, something you couldn't quantify. We finally understood why we had been called here by the military to consult. We interviewed every child involved in the incident, as well as the homeroom teacher and the attending physician. Major Toyama also participated. But these interviews yielded almost nothing new. We merely confirmed what the major had already told us. The children had no memory whatsoever of the event. They saw what looked like a plane glinting high up in the sky, climbed up Owanyama and began hunting for mushrooms. Then there's a gap in time, and the next thing they recall is lying on the ground, surrounded by a group of worried-looking teachers and policemen. They felt fine. No pain, discomfort, or nausea. Their minds just felt a bit blank, as they do when you first wake up in the morning. That was all. Each child gave the exact same response. After conducting these interviews, we concluded that this was a case of mass hypnosis. From the symptoms the homeroom teacher and the school doctor observed at the scene, this hypothesis made the most sense. The regular movement of the eyes, the slight lowering of respiration, heartbeat and temperature, the lack of memory, it all fit. Only the teacher didn't lose consciousness because, for whatever reason, what produced this mass hypnosis didn't affect adults. We weren't able to pinpoint the cause, however. Generally speaking, though, mass hypnotism requires two elements. First, the group must be close-knit and homogeneous and placed in restricted circumstances. Second, something has to trigger the reaction, something that acts simultaneously on the whole group. In this case, it might have been the glint of that airplane they saw. This is just a hypothesis, mind you. We weren't able to find any other candidates, and there may very well have been some other trigger that set it off. I broached the idea of it being a case of mass hypnosis with Major Toyama, making it clear this was merely a conjecture. My two colleagues generally concurred. Coincidentally, this also happened to be indirectly related to a research topic we were investigating ourselves. That does seem to fit the evidence, Major Toyomar said, after giving it some thought. This is not my field, but it would appear to be the likeliest explanation. But there's one thing I don't understand. What made them snap out of this mass hypnosis? There'd have to be some sort of reverse triggering mechanism. I really don't know, I admitted. All I could do was speculate. My hypothesis was this, that there is a system in place which, after a certain amount of time passes, automatically breaks the spell. Our bodies have strong defense mechanisms in place, and if an outside system takes over momentarily, once a certain amount of time has passed, it's as if an alarm bell goes off, activating an emergency system that deprograms this foreign object that blocks our built-in defenses. In this case, the effects of mass hypnosis, and eliminates it. Unfortunately, I don't have the materials in front of me, so I can't quote the precise figures. But, as I told Major Toyomar, there have been reports of similar incidents occurring abroad. All of them are considered mysteries, with no logical explanation. A large number of children lose consciousness at the same time, and several hours later wake up without any memory of what happened. This incident is quite unusual, in other words, but not without precedent. One strange instance took place around 1930, on the outskirts of a small village in Devonshire, England. For no apparent reason, a group of 30 junior high students walking down a country lane fell to the ground, one after the other, and lost consciousness. Several hours later, though, as if nothing had happened, they regained consciousness and walked back to school under their own steam. A doctor examined them right away, but could find nothing medically wrong. Not one of them could recall what had taken place. At the end of the last century, a similar incident occurred in Australia. Outside of Adelaide, 15 teenage girls from a private girls' school were on an outing when all of them lost consciousness, and then regained it. Again, there were no injuries, no after-effects. It ended up classified as a case of heat stroke, but all of them had lost consciousness and recovered it at nearly the same time, and nobody showed symptoms of heat stroke. So the real cause remains a mystery. Besides, it wasn't a particularly hot day when it occurred. Probably there was no other accounting for what had taken place, so they decided that this was the best explanation. These cases have several things in common. They took place among a group of either young boys or girls, somewhat distant from their school, all of whom lost consciousness more or less simultaneously and then regained it at about the same time, with no one displaying any after-effects. It's reported that some of the adults who happened to be with the children also lost consciousness, and some did not. Each case was different in that regard. There are other similar incidents, but these two are the best documented, and thus are representative cases in the literature of this phenomenon. This recent instance in Yamanashi Prefecture, however, contains one element that differentiates it from the rest, namely that one boy did not that day regain consciousness. This child is the key to unlocking the truth to this event. We returned to Tokyo after our interviews in Yamanashi and went straight to the army hospital where the boy was being cared for.
The army then was only interested in this incident because they suspected it may have been caused by poison gas?
That's my understanding. But Major Toyomar would know more about this, and I suggest you ask him directly.
Major Toyomar was killed in Tokyo in March 1945, in the line of duty, during an air raid.
I'm very sorry to hear that. We lost so many promising people in the war.
Eventually, though, the army concluded that this was not caused by any chemical weapons, and they couldn't determine the cause, But they decided, didn't they, that it was unrelated to the war?
Yes, I believe that's true. At this point, they'd concluded their investigation into the matter. The boy, Nakata, was allowed to remain in the military hospital, though, since Major Toyama was personally interested in the case and had some connections there. So we were able to go to the military hospital every day and take turns staying overnight to investigate this unconscious boy's case further, from a number of angles. Though he was unconscious, the boy's bodily functions nevertheless continued normally. He was given nutrients intravenously and discharged urine at regular intervals. He shut his eyes at night and went to sleep when we turned out the lights, then opened them again in the morning. Other than being unconscious, he appeared healthy. He was in a coma, but he didn't dream, apparently. When people dream, they exhibit characteristic eye movements and facial expressions. Your heart rate goes up as you react to experiences in your dreams. But with the Nakata boy, we couldn't detect any of these indicators. His heart rate, breathing, and temperature were still slightly on the low side, but surprisingly stable. It might sound strange to put it this way, but it seemed like the real Nakata had gone off somewhere, leaving behind for a time the physical container which, in his absence, kept all his bodily functions going at the minimum level needed to preserve itself. The term spirit projection sprang to mind. Are you familiar with it? Japanese folk tales are full of this sort of thing, where the soul temporarily leaves the body, goes off a great distance to take care of some vital task, and then returns to reunite with the body. The sort of vengeful spirits that populate the tale of Genji may be something similar. The notion of the soul not just leaving the body at death, but, assuming the will is strong enough, also being able to separate from the body of the living, is probably an idea that took root in Japan in ancient times. Of course, there's no scientific proof of this, and I hesitate even to propose the idea. The practical problem that faced us was how to wake this boy from his coma and restore him to consciousness. Struggling to find a reverse trigger to undo the hypnosis, we tried everything. We brought his parents there, had them shout out his name. We tried that for several days, but there was no reaction. We tried every trick in the book as far as hypnosis goes, clapping our hands in different ways right in front of his face. We played music he knew, read his school books aloud to him, let him catch a whiff of his favourite foods. We even brought in his cat from home, one he was particularly fond of. We used every method we could think of to bring him back to reality, but nothing worked. About 2 weeks into this, though, when we'd run out of ideas and were exhausted and discouraged, the boy woke up of his own accord. Not because of anything we'd done. Without warning, as if the time for this had been decided in advance, he came to.
Did anything out of the ordinary take place that day?
Nothing worth mentioning. It was a day like any other. At 10 a.m. the nurse came to draw a blood sample. Right after that, he choked a bit, and some of the blood spilled on the sheets. Not much, and they changed the sheets right away. That was about the only thing different that day. The boy woke up about a half hour after that. Out of the blue, he sat up in bed, stretched, and looked around the room. He'd regained consciousness, and medically he was perfectly fine. Soon, though, we realized he'd lost all his memory. He couldn't even remember his own name. The place he lived in, his school, his parents' faces, it was all gone. He couldn't read, and wasn't even aware that this was Japan or the Earth. He couldn't even fathom the concept of Japan or the Earth. he'd return to this world with his mind wiped clean. The proverbial blank slate.
9. When I come to, I'm in thick undergrowth, lying there on the damp ground like some log. I can't see a thing, it's so dark. My head propped up by prickly brambles. I take a deep breath and smell plants and earth and mixed in a faint whiff of dog shit. I can see the night sky through the tree branches. There's no moon or stars, but the sky is strangely bright. The clouds act as a screen, reflecting the light from below. An ambulance wails off in the distance, grows closer, then fades away. Listening closely, I can just catch the rumble of tires from traffic. I reckon I must be in some corner of the city. I try to pull myself together and pick up the scattered jigsaw puzzle pieces of me lying all around. This is a first, I think. Or is it? I had this feeling somewhere before. But when? I search my memory, but that fragile thread snaps. I close my eyes and let time pass by. With a jolt of panic, I remember my backpack. Where could I have left it? There's no way I can lose it. Everything I own's inside. But how am I going to find it in the dark? I try to get to my feet, but my fingers have lost all their strength. I struggle to raise my left hand. Why is it so heavy all of a sudden? And bring my wristwatch close to my face, fixing my eyes on it. The digital numbers read 11:26, May 28. I think of my diary. May 28. Good. So I haven't lost a day. I haven't been lying here out cold for days. At most, my consciousness and I parted company for a few hours. Maybe 4 hours. May 28. A day like any other. The exact same routine. Nothing out of the ordinary. I went to the gym. Then to the Comera Library. Did my usual workout on the machines. Read Soseki on the same sofa. Had dinner near the station. The fish dinner, as I recall. Salmon, with a second helping of rice, some miso soup and salad. After that, I don't know what happened. My left shoulder aches a little. As my senses return, so does the pain. I must have bumped into something pretty solid. I rub that part with my right hand. There's no wound or swelling. Did I get hit by a car, perhaps? But my clothes aren't torn, and the only place that hurts is that spot in my left shoulder. Probably just a bruise. I fumble around in the bushes, but all I touch are branches, hard and twisted like the hearts of bullied little animals. No backpack. I go through my trouser pockets. My wallet's there, thank God. Some cash is in it, the hotel key card, a phone card. Besides this, I've got a coin purse, a handkerchief, a ballpoint pen. As far as I can tell in the dark, nothing's missing. I'm wearing cream-coloured chinos, a white V-neck T-shirt under a long-sleeve check shirt, plus my navy blue topsiders. My cap's vanished. My New York Yankees baseball cap. I know I had it on when I left the hotel, but not now. I must have dropped it, or left it someplace. No big deal. They're to a penny. Eventually, I locate my backpack, leaning up against the trunk of a pine tree. Why in the world would I leave it there and then scramble into this thicket, only to collapse? Where the hell am I, anyway? My memory's frozen shut. Anyway, the important thing is I found it. I take out my mini torch from a side pocket and check the contents. Nothing seems to be missing. Thank God the sack with all my cash is there. I shoulder the backpack and step over bushes, brushing branches out of the way, until I reach a small clearing. There's a narrow path there, and I follow the beam of my torch into a place where there are some lights. It appears to be the grounds of a Shinto shrine. I'd lost consciousness in a small wood behind the main shrine building. A mercury lamp on a high pole illuminates the extensive grounds, casting a kind of cold light on the inner shrine, the offering box, the votive tablets. My shadow looks weirdly long on the gravel. I find the shrine's name on the bulletin board and commit it to memory. Nobody else is around. I see a toilet nearby and go inside, and it turns out to be fairly clean. I take off my backpack and wash my face, then check my reflection in the blurry mirror over the sink. I prepare myself for the worst, and I'm not disappointed. I look like hell. A pale face with sunken cheeks stares back at me, my neck all muddy, hair sticking out in all directions. I notice something dark on the front of my white T-shirt, shaped sort of like a huge butterfly with wings spread. I try brushing it away, but it won't come off. I touch it, and my hands come away all sticky. I need to calm down, so consciously taking my time, I take off both my shirts. Under the flickering fluorescent light, I realize what this is. Darkish blood that seeped into the fabric. The blood's still fresh, wet, and there's lots of it. I bring it close for a sniff, but there's no smell. Blood's been spattered on the checked shirt as well, but only a little, and it doesn't stand out on the dark blue material. The blood on the T-shirt's another matter. Against the white background, there's no mistaking that. I wash the T-shirt in the sink. The blood mixes with the water, dyeing the porcelain sink red. Though no matter how hard I scrub, the stain won't come out. I'm about to toss the shirt into the rubbish bin, then decide against it. If I have to throw it away, some other place is better. I wring out the shirt and stow it in the plastic bag with my other rinsed-out clothes, and stuff the whole thing into my backpack. I wet my hair and try to get some of the tangles out. Then I take some soap out of my wash bag and wash my hands. They're still trembling a little, but I take my time, carefully washing between my fingers and under my fingernails. With a damp towel, I wipe away the blood that seeped onto my chest. Then I put on my checked shirt, button it up to the neck, and tuck it into my trousers. I don't want people looking at me, so I've got to look at least halfway normal. But I'm scared, and my teeth won't stop chattering. Try as I might, I can't get them to stop. I stretch out my hands and look at them. They too are shaking a bit. They look like somebody else's hands, not my own. Like a pair of little animals with a life all their own. My palms sting as if I'd grabbed a hot metal bar. I rest my hands against the sink and lean forward, my head shoved against the mirror. I feel like crying, but even if I did, nobody's going to come to my rescue. Nobody. Man alive, how do you get so much blood all over you? What the hell were you doing? But you don't remember a thing, do you? No wounds, though. That's a relief. No real pain either, except for that throbbing in your left shoulder. So the blood's got to be from somebody else, not you. Somebody else's blood. Anyway, you can't stay here forever. If a patrol car happened to spot you here, covered with blood, you're up a creek, my friend. Of course, going back to the hotel might not be a good idea. You don't know who might be lying in wait, ready to jump you. You can't be too careful. Looks as if you've been involved in some crime, something you don't remember. Maybe you were the villain. Who knows? Lucky you got all your stuff with you. You were always careful enough to lug everything you own around in that heavy backpack. Good choice. You did what's right, so don't worry. Don't be afraid. Everything's going to work out. 'Cause face it, you're the toughest 15-year-old on the planet, right? Get a hold of yourself. Take some deep breaths and start using your head. Things'll be fine. But you have to be very careful. That's real blood we're talking about. Somebody else's blood. And we're not just talking a drop or two. As we speak, I'll bet someone's trying to track you down. Better get a move on. There's only one thing to do, one place you got to go to. And you know where that is. I take a couple of deep breaths to calm myself down, then pick up my pack and get out of the toilet. I crunch along the gravel, the mercury light beating down on me, and try to get my brain in gear. Throw the switch, turn the handle, get the old thought process up and running. But it doesn't work. Not enough juice in the battery to get the engine to turn over. I need somewhere that's safe and warm, where I can escape to for a while and pull myself together. But where? The only place that comes to mind is the library. But the Commoner Library's closed until tomorrow at 11, and I need somewhere to lie low till then. I come up with an alternative. I sit down where nobody can see me, and take the mobile phone from my backpack. I check to see if it's still connected, then take Sakura's phone number from my wallet, and punch in the numbers. My fingers still aren't working well, and it takes a few times before I get the whole number punched in right. I don't get her voicemail, thank God. 12 rings later, she answers. I tell her my name. Kafka Tamura, she repeats, not exactly thrilled. Do you have any idea how late it is? I've got to get up early tomorrow. I know. I'm sorry to call so late, I tell her. My voice sounds tense. But I had no choice. I'm sort of in trouble, and you're the only one I could think of. No response at the other end. It seems she's checking my tone of voice, weighing it in her mind. Is it something serious? She finally asks. I can't tell you right now, but I think so. You've got to help me. Just this once. I promise I won't be a bother. She gives it some thought. Not as if she's confused or anything, just thinking it over. So where are you? I tell her the name of the shrine. Is that in Takamatsu City? I'm not absolutely sure, but I think so. You don't even know where you are, she says, dumbfounded. It's a long story. She lets out a sigh. Find a taxi and come to the Lawson's convenience store on the corner near my apartment. They have a big sign, and you can't miss it. She gives me the directions. Do you have money for a taxi? I'm good, I say. All right, she says, and hangs up. I go out the Torii gate at the entrance to the shrine and head for the main road to flag down a taxi. It doesn't take long. I ask the driver if he knows the Lawsons on that corner, and he says he does. When I ask if it's a long way, he says no, about a 1,000 yen ride. The taxi stops outside the Lawsons, and I pay the driver, my hands still unsteady. I pick up my backpack and go inside the shop. I got there so fast, Sakura hasn't arrived yet. I buy a small carton of milk, heat it up in the microwave, and sip it slowly. The warm milk slips down my throat and calms my stomach a little. When I went inside the shop, the clerk glanced at my backpack, keeping an eye out for shoplifters. But after that, nobody pays any attention to me. I stand at the magazine rack, pretending to be picking out one, and check out my reflection in the window. Though my hair's still a bit of a mess, you can barely see the blood on my checked shirt. If anybody noticed it, they'd think it was just a stain. Now all I have to do is stop trembling. 10 minutes later, Sakura strolls in. It's nearly 1 a.m. She has on a plain grey sweatshirt and faded jeans. Her hair's in a ponytail, and she's wearing a navy blue New Balance cap. The moment I catch sight of her, my teeth finally stop chattering. She sidles up beside me and looks me over carefully, as if she's examining the teeth of a dog she's about to buy. She lets out a sound halfway between a sigh and actual words, then lightly pats me twice on the shoulder. "Come on," she says. Her apartment's 2 blocks from the Lawsons, a tacky, 2-story building. She walks upstairs, takes the keys from her pocket and opens the green paneled door. The apartment consists of 2 rooms plus a kitchen and bathroom. The walls are thin, the floors creak, and probably the only natural light the place gets is when the blinding sunset shines in. I hear a toilet flush in some other unit, the scrape of a cabinet being shut somewhere. Seedy, all right.